If you look in your handouts, for those who have them, and welcome any who are here for the first time tonight. We're glad you're able to make it. Nice to have you with us. Sorry that we can't go back over everything we've seen in lectures 1 to 7 this evening, you'll understand. But we start tonight with lecture 8, and it is our... Yes, if there's someone that... Yeah, that's very good. Thank you, Jeff. We start in lecture 8 this evening, the Old Covenant, which is Unit 7 in the outline. And hopefully also this evening we'll cover Lecture 9, the Davidic Covenant, which is Unit 8. That's where we're hoping to go tonight. So we start now with the Mosaic or Old Covenant. Now, I always like to use the inductive method rather than deductive. And yet, in this case, that's going to be difficult because there are a lot of passages in the Scriptures, and I have selected some 20 texts in the Old Testament and 5 in the New, which reveal the substance of the Old Covenant. And then I have on my next sheet of notes here an effort to collate this under the headings of the features of the Old Covenant. So here's the way we open up this unit. And I think I call this unit what? Unit 7? Did I say it's Unit 7? Yeah. Lecture 8, Unit 7. Yeah, okay, Unit 7. The Mosaic or Old Covenant. And under this I have 5 headings, the foundations, the features. And what comes after features? Oh, I know. Fellowship. That's a heading that I changed many, many times. I used to call it the cultus. That's weird, huh? But it comes from Hebrews chapter 9. Even the first covenant had what Hebrews 9 calls ordinances of divine service. That God, under the old covenant, set up a system by which God's people would fellowship with Him. There was a system of fellowship between God and His people under the old covenant. And then the fourth thing has to do with how the Old Covenant promise is fulfilled. And finally, the functions of the Old Covenant in redemptive history. What functions did it have in redemptive history? Where does it fit in redemptive history? Like, for example, there's a clear passage that indicates this. And there's a clear passage that indicates this. There's a clear passage that indicates this. That's a 2. And, of course, the features of the Old Covenant, there are many passages that represent these, as we'll see. But that it's built upon foundations is abundantly clear. That it involves fellowship with God is abundantly clear. That it's fulfilled in a given way, they broke it, is abundantly clear. That it functions in redemptive history with a special function. What then was the law? It was added because of transgressions till the seed should come to whom the promise has been made. So it was intended to be temporary, and it had a specific function in redemptive history. That whole category is introduced by Scripture. So in suggesting these categories, I'm not imposing these categories on the Bible. I believe the Bible calls upon us to think in these categories about this relationship, this covenantal relationship between God and His people redeemed from Egypt. Okay, so that's the overview of it. Now, the 5 features that I see are the partakers of it, who partook of it, the substance of it, what exactly was the covenant, the ratification of it, when, where, and how was it put in force, the mediator of it, who mediated it, and the token of it, what was given as a token of the Old Covenant. Jeff, does anybody else feel warm in here besides me, or is it just me?
It's never just you.
It's never just me, okay? Because my concern about that is not that, you know, I'm going to start sweating and stuff. My concern about that, what's going to happen is, you know, how it's going to be. So people are going to have a hard time concentrating, and then I'm going to start sleeping. I'm going to roll my sleeves up, take my tie off, and all kinds of things are going to happen in a few minutes. Oh, I'm going to deal with them. I will mention them probably ad nauseum, Jamie. This is just, I'm writing this up here to give an overview. Because what I'm going to do is I'm going to use a combination of the deductive and inductive method in teaching these things. Okay? So first of all, I'm going to deal with the foundations. And let's look very briefly at the passage that we looked at last time, which is in Exodus chapter 6. But let's look at the three foundations of the Mosaic Covenant. I see three of them here in this text. Three very clear foundations. Exodus chapter 6, three foundations. And the Lord spoke to Moses and said, I am the Lord, and I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as God Almighty. Verse 4, and I have also established my covenant with them, with the patriarchs, to give them the land of Canaan, which we looked at last time, the land of their sojournings. And moreover, I have heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians keep in bondage, and I have remembered my covenant. There's the first foundation right there. The first foundation of the covenant between God and Israel and Hebrew Israel is that God has remembered and God is fulfilling the covenant that he made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That this covenant is built on the foundation of God's faithfulness and fulfilling his covenant promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that their seed would inherit the land of Canaan. Is that clear? Okay, second foundation. Wherefore, verse 6, say to the children of Israel, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, and will rid you of their bondage, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgments. There's a second foundation, is redemption accomplished. What redemption? The story of that redemption is given to us in Exodus 7 all the way through Exodus 14. It's redemption from Egypt, redemption from slavery. It's not redemption from sin. It's redemption from slavery in Egypt. That whole nation was redeemed from slavery in Egypt. That whole nation passed through the Red Sea as on dry ground. I recently heard a very interesting story about this. And I forget, was it you told me this, Pastor Jeff? Somebody did. This was a miraculous, supernatural, divine act that they were saved from the Israelites, and they were saved from the Egyptians, and they were saved when God miraculously opened the waters of the Red Sea and they went through on dry ground. And I thought we were recently talking about this, about some people who try to deny the supernatural in the Old Testament and say, oh, well, don't you know, that was just the 6 inches of water in the Reed Sea. And that was the 6 inches of water, and there was only 6 inches of water there in the Reed Sea, and that's how they passed through on dry ground. And somebody remarked to that, well, now isn't this amazing? It's even a greater miracle that all those Egyptians drowned in 6 inches of water. And the horses, too, in 6 inches of water, they all drowned. Well, that it was a miracle, wasn't it? Oh, that's amazing. Well, how miraculous. So I thought, well, that's funny. I'll pass that on to you. I think it was Pastor Jeff told me. I never heard that before. And I thought, that's really good. You want to believe in miracles? There's one for you. They all drown in 6 inches of water. What a miracle. But anyway, I don't believe that they drown in 6 inches of water. That's ridiculous. They drown in the Red Sea. When the waters of the Red Sea came back on top of them miraculously, just as they opened up miraculously and the people went through. Well, here's the point. The point is that God supernaturally, with supernatural power, saved those people. But he didn't save them from sin. Because most of them, in their unbelief, perished in the wilderness, as we read concerning them. They weren't believers, most of them, in God, even though God miraculously saved them. Saved them from slavery. Saved them from the Egyptians when he opened up the Red Sea. And he brought them out into the wilderness. So, and that remarkable redemption from Egypt is the foundation of this covenant. So listen to this. This covenant, you hear anything picturesque in this? This old covenant is given to a redeemed people. God redeemed them. And out, and they were supposed to do what he said out of gratitude and love to the God who redeemed them. Now that doesn't sound like works religion to me. That doesn't sound like it. It sounds like grace to me. It sounds like they should have been motivated by grace out of gratitude to a God and love to a God who freely, in fulfillment of his faithfulness to his promise to their fathers, the patriarchs, redeemed them with his mighty hand and his outstretched arm and his supernatural power out of Egypt and set them free. So it's appropriate to say that the law was given to a redeemed people. That's absolutely right. Now in verse 7, it speaks about the making of this covenant, as I'll show you later. And I will take you to me for a people, and I will be to you a God. And you will know that I am your God, Jehovah, who brings you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. It's in the wilderness between the Red Sea and the River Jordan. It's in that wilderness that he takes them to himself. And he becomes their God, as he promised Abraham in Genesis 17, verse 7 and 8. He promised Abraham that he would be a God to Abraham's posterity. And that when he took them to himself for his people, that he would give them the land of Canaan, which is the third foundation. At the very same time, at the moment when they passed out of the wilderness, they crossed the River Jordan, and where do they go? They go into that inheritance, into that promised land, and the story is told in the book of Joshua, as we saw in the fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant last night, where they go into the land, they receive their inheritance. God continues to drive the Canaanites out from before them. And so God gives them this covenant, a covenant to keep in the land which he gives them to live in. And so he finishes giving them the book of the law on the plains of Moab, and that's recorded in Deuteronomy, just before he miraculously opens the River Jordan, and they march across the Jordan just like they marched across the sea. Now, it's no accident that you have this miraculous crossing of these two bodies of water. God miraculously brings them into the wilderness. He miraculously takes them out of the wilderness, and it's in that wilderness that he takes them to himself for a people. First, he redeems them, redemption accomplished, and they go in. Then they go out, and he gives them their inheritance. Inheritance bestowed, the land of Canaan. So this group of people is God's redeemed heirs. They are redeemed from Egypt, and they inherit Canaan. And they do that miraculously crossing the two bodies of water by divine power. He divinely leads them into their inheritance in Canaan by supernatural power. He divinely redeems them from Egypt by supernatural power. And in the wilderness, he takes them to himself for a people, making the old covenant with them in the wilderness. He begins to make this old covenant right after, about 3 months after they cross the sea at Mount Sinai, and he completes this old covenant just before they enter the promised land on the plains of Moab, across from the Jordan in Deuteronomy. And the record of the establishment of this covenant with that wilderness generation of Jews is given to us in Exodus to Deuteronomy. Now, does that make sense? So I tell you the foundations of the establishment of the Old Covenant are, number one, the fulfillment of the promise to the patriarchs, that God fulfills it. And number two, redemption from Egypt. And number three, bestowal of the inheritance in Canaan. And sandwiched between those two great redemptive acts of taking them out of Egypt and bringing them to Canaan is the wilderness experience in which God takes them to himself for a people and makes covenant with them. Does that make sense? Yeah. Right. Good. Now that's the foundations. Now we come to what I promised to say ad nauseum. The features of the Old Covenant. Now here is where we become a little bit inductive again. The features of the Old Covenant. And here I have five features. Features of the Old Covenant. And I'm just going to erase this so we don't get confused. So three foundations, five features. A, I hope I don't run out of space on the board. B, C, D, and E. Okay, the first question, if God's going to make a pledge with somebody, with whom is the pledge made? So who are the partakers of the Old Covenant? We go through these texts. You keep this in mind, okay? And we're going to have under partakers, we have the initial generation, and we have successive generations, and we have the final generation. Okay? Then the second question is, what is the substance or promise? Substance or promise. The old writers refer to the partakers as the parties of the covenant. The promise of the old covenant. What is the promise? What is the pledge? What did God pledge to them? What did he pledge them? What did he promise them with an oath? If so, what is it? Okay? And I'm going to submit to you that there is a twofold substance. Okay. Thirdly, how about the ratification of this? All right, this happened in history. How? When was it ratified or put in force? How? Was there a ceremony? And where? Some more questions about in what manner, in what place, and at what time was this put in force? Mediation. How did God bring this to pass? Was it through his direct dealing with the entire community, or did he do it through some servant that mediated it for him? And finally, is there a token? As the rainbow and as circumcision were tokens of the Noahic covenant and the Abrahamic covenant, respectively, is there a token of the old covenant that stands for it, and if so, what is identified with the Old Covenant explicitly in Scripture as its token? Okay? Fair enough. That seemed like legitimate issues that you want to know the answer to? You do. Good. Okay, let's start. Exodus. Where do we start? We start in Exodus 19. Now, this is, first of all, with the substance, whatever the substance of this covenant is, you want to know that the new covenant is a better covenant built upon better promises, because the New Testament says that. Okay, let's look at Exodus 19, 5 and 6. Exodus 19, 5 and 6. Let's see what it says. Exodus 19. Now in the third month, so it's about 3 months after they go over the sea. Verse 1. When the children of Israel come up from the land of Egypt, they came to the wilderness of Sinai. And then it says where they were departed, etc. And then verse 3. And Moses went up unto God. Now that's where this all started. Remember on that mountain where Moses saw the burning bush? Now he's back at that mountain where the bush burned. And God had told them in those days that they were going to worship him on that mountain. Now here they are, back at that mountain, just like God said. Now he's got the whole community with him. And this is what he says. Thus shall you say to the house of Jacob and tell the children of Israel, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians, how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. This is his dwelling place. And now, therefore, if you will obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you will be mine own possession from among all peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you will be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak unto the children of Israel. Now, what do you learn about the recipients of this covenant here in Exodus 19, 5 and 6? Say unto the children of Israel, if you will obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be. So, first of all, with whom? What do you learn about with whom this covenant is made? The whole generation, right? It's plural. The whole society and nation of the children of Israel that came out of Egypt and that were redeemed from Egypt. Would you agree? Right. I agree. Absolutely right. So it's the wilderness generation of Israel that experienced the redemption from bondage. Right? That experienced it firsthand. Agreed? Those that experience redemption firsthand, those people, it's made with them. What is the substance of it? What does God promise them? What does he say? Okay. Is that it? It just, if you obey, then, okay, you will be my own possession from among all peoples. You're going to be a special possession. And what else? They're going to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. That's the promise. Now, does that language at all sound familiar to you? Kingdom of priests and holy nation? I mean, where do you run across language like that? Where do you run across that type of language? Where? First Peter. Right. So this group of people has promised to them that they will be a kingdom of priests, a royal priesthood, and a holy nation, and God's own special possession from among all the peoples. Now, can you say this is period, or is there something else that goes along with it? This promise, does it have a condition or is it unconditional? It has a condition. And what word introduces the condition? If. A simple if. 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 And what is it that they have to do? Obey what? Okay, obey his voice. So they have to obey the voice of God, which equals keep his covenant. Keep my pledge equals obey my voice. Okay? And if they do that, then there will come blessing upon them as a nation. And as a nation, they will be a kingdom of priests, and they will be perpetuated as God's special people. entering into being a holy nation and a kingdom of priests and God's special people. This is the promised blessing of a unique relationship to God that will be perpetuated, and it is conditioned upon walking in gospel obedience to the voice of God. The voice of God. What's the voice of God? What is this voice of God? All right? They have to obey the voice of God. And I tell you that this is not just a little accidental use of words here, the voice of God. This is not a figurative use of words, the voice of God. Because that voice of God was about to utter to them the covenant and the words of the covenant of God and the words of the pledge and what God expected them to do. These people were about to see and hear things which no other people on the face of the earth had ever seen before or ever seen since or ever heard before or ever heard since. This whole nation was about to hear with their own ears the voice of God speak out of heaven to them. That's remarkable. Later on in the Pentateuch, Moses says, what nation ever heard God speak out of heaven with his own voice to them before? Nobody ever heard that before. Nobody ever heard that since. God never came down out of heaven in 1776 and spoke to our American forefathers. God never came down out of heaven and spoke to any other founding fathers of any nation on the face of the earth. But he did come down out of heaven on Mount Sinai and spoke to the founding fathers. Look at Exodus chapter 20. Exodus chapter 20. Let's look at verse 9, first of all. Let's look at the story here. And Moses came and called the elders of the people, verse 7. Set before them all these words which the Lord commanded. He tells them about the covenant promise. And all the people answered, everything the Lord has said we will do. And then Moses reports the words to the Lord. So here's Moses as a go-between. He comes down from the mountain and he tells the people what God said. Then he hears what the people said, goes back up and tells God what the people said. That's a mediator. That's a go-between. That's what he's doing. He's functioning as a communicator between God and the people. And the Lord said, and the Lord said, go unto the people and get them ready. Sanctify them today and tomorrow. Let them wash their clothes. Be ready for the third day. On the third day, the Lord will come down in the sight of all the people on Mount Sinai. They're going to see the phenomenon associated with the special presence of God. They're going to see it. They're going to see it. And then you read the rest of the story about what happens here. And it comes to pass on the third day. Well, there's a place in here where I'm trying to find the exact passage. Well, they're very careful. They can't come near, the men can't come near a woman. You have to set bounds around the mountain. You can't even come close to the mountain. On the third day, verse 16, in the morning, there were thunder and lightning and a thick cloud on the top of the mountain and the voice of a trumpet, very loud. Moses came forth and the people out of the camp, and they stood at the backside of the mountain, and the whole mountain was smoking because the Lord descended on it in fire. What a sight. And the smoke of the furnace and the mountain quaked greatly, and the voice of the trumpet got louder and louder. Moses spoke, God answered him by a voice. And the Lord came down on Mount Sinai, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mount. Moses went up, and he said, go down to the people. I don't want them coming through. Sanctify yourselves, and etc. Get down. Don't let people come through, etc. And then something happened. God spoke with an audible voice out of heaven. And he spoke these words. Exodus chapter 20. I am Jehovah your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt and out of the house of bondage. And then he finishes speaking down in verse 17. And verse 18 says, "And all the people perceived the thunderings and the lightnings and the voice of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. When the people saw it, they trembled. And Moses said, 'You speak with us and we will hear, but let not God speak with us, lest we die.'" When they heard God with his own voice speak these words out of heaven, they were absolutely, utterly terrified. And the words which the voice of God spoke were the Ten Commandments. As we'll see, other places in the Pentateuch reflect upon this incident and say, "You heard the voice of God speak these words out of heaven, and he added no more." And you'll also see that those Ten Commandments are later by God himself engraved on tables of stone. And those Ten Commandments engraved on tables of stone are what the voice of God uttered and spoke to them. And it's what they are to keep. They are the very essence of the Old Covenant, as we'll see as we go through the passages. So this is the first passage of tremendous significance. Second passage is Exodus 24, 7 and 8. Now, in between this, what's happened is the people have said, "We don't want to hear the voice of God speaking anymore. It's too frightening. We don't want to hear God ourselves. So Moses, you go up there, hear what he has to say, and come back and tell us." So Moses does that, and in chapter 21, 22, 23 is recorded everything that God spoke to Moses. Now observe what happens here in chapter 24. "And he," that is God, "said to Moses, 'Come up unto Jehovah, you and Aaron and Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and you worship afar off, but Moses alone comes near to the Lord,'" that is to this place where God's special presence is made known. "'They shall not come near, neither shall the people go up.' And Moses told the people all the words of the Lord and all the ordinances," chapters 21 to 23. "And all the people answered with one voice and said, 'All the words which the Lord has spoken we will do.'" And listen. "And Moses wrote all the words of the Lord." He wrote them all down. Everything that's recorded in Exodus 21 to 23, Moses wrote it all down. "And rose up early in the morning and built an altar under the mountain and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes. And he sent the young men who offered burnt offerings and sacrifices. Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins. Half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar, and he took the book of the covenant and read in the audience of the people. And they said, 'All that the Lord has spoken, we will do and be obedient.' And he took the blood and sprinkled it on the people and said, 'Behold, the blood of the covenant which Jehovah has made with you concerning all these words.'" Okay? So what do you find about the content of the Old Covenant there? And about the ratification of the Old Covenant? The book. The book. The book. The book. The book of the covenant. The book. And at this point, that book contains the ordinances and statutes written in 21:1 to 23:33. At this point, 21:1 to 23:33. The book of the covenant. And how did Moses, and the book of Hebrews reflects upon this, how did Moses ratify this covenant? What did he do? Was there a ceremony? Was there some activity that Moses went through? What was it? What was that activity and ceremony that Moses went through at that point? What did he actually do? That's right. It was a sprinkling of blood. There was association of blood. And it was a sprinkling of blood upon the book and upon the people. Right. Sprinkle blood on them and on the book. Indicating the permanence and the seriousness of this covenant. Okay? Clear? So ratify with blood, Exodus 24, 6 to 8. This is reflected on and this reality is reflected on in Hebrews 9, 18 to 20. I won't turn you there right now. But in Hebrews 9, 18 to 20, it's clear that that's the case, and that's reflected on how the whole covenant was established with blood, and the ratification of the covenant took place through the sprinkling of the blood. And obviously, does that remind you of anything? This cup is the new covenant in my blood. The new covenant is ratified through the blood of Christ, like the old covenant is ratified through this sprinkling of blood upon the people and upon the book. Okay? There's also a ceremonial meal associated with this ratification. And this ceremonial meal is described here in verses 9 through 11. They went up and they saw the God of Israel, or some kind of an appearance of a theophany, and they did eat and drink in verse 11. So there's some kind of a ceremonial meal also associated with this. There's a ceremonial meal in Exodus 24, 9 to 11. Okay? There's the blood and there's the meal. Now, I'm not going to try to draw exact parallel, but to me it's not totally an accident that when he says, this cup is the new covenant in my blood, that there is the eating of a ceremonial meal associated with the ratification of the new covenant as well. The ceremonial meal is different, but the elders, the apostles, are there, the elders of Israel, and so the apostles, who are the leaders of New Covenant Israel, are there eating a ceremonial meal with the Lord Jesus upon the occasion of the shedding of his blood. And to me, I see certain parallel in that as well. There's a ceremonial meal eaten by the elders in the presence of God, which they, quote, see God. Jesus says, he that has seen me has seen the Father. So they see God and they eat with God. And there's the shedding of blood in conjunction with the ratifying of the covenant. All right. Exodus 31. Verse 16. Now, you have to remember the language of Genesis 14. Genesis 17, 14, and 9 to 14. And in that language, speaking of circumcision, the sign of the covenant, remember what he says? He says, this is my covenant which you shall keep. Just like this cup is the new covenant. The token or sign of the covenant is identified with the covenant. Just like I might say to you, this is the covenant that my wife made with me. This ring, this is the covenant. Because this is the token of her pledge to me. It's the visible token identified with it. And I might say, this is her covenant, her marriage covenant. And she could point to my wedding ring that I gave her, and she could say, this is the covenant that my husband made with me. So that's the language of the Bible. The Bible speaks that way about circumcision. It speaks that way about the Lord's Supper. Keep that in mind as we read this passage. Exodus 31. Verse 15, 6 days you shall work, but on the seventh day, Saturday, is a Sabbath of solemn rest. Saturday is a Sabbath. Saturday is a Sabbath, back in Exodus 31. Saturday is a Sabbath. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day, Saturday, shall surely be put to death. Wherefore, the children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath to observe the Sabbath throughout their generations for a perpetual covenant. It is a sign between me and the children of Israel forever. For in 6 days The Lord made heaven and earth, and on the seventh he rested and was refreshed. And then, just after that, he gives him something very significant. And he gave to Moses, when he had made an end of communing with him upon the mountain, the two tables of the testimony, the tables of stone, written with the finger of God. Now, is there anything here associated with the old covenant that is said to be a sign between God and the people of Israel forever? Yes. The Sabbath. And for lack of a better word, I'm going to call it the Hebrew Sabbath. Because in the Hebrew Sabbath, I'm referring to Saturday. Okay? I'm referring to Saturday, the seventh day. And that's Exodus 31, 16, and 17. Now, here's an interesting reality that we have to resolve in the Bible. That which was a creation ordinance, the Sabbath day, has become a covenant sign. And it's become a sign of the old covenant. So observing the Sabbath on Saturday is a sign of the old covenant between God and Israel. It's a sign of that. When God sees, and this is interesting, remember the significance of the sign? When God sees Hebrew Israel on Saturday, back in those days, observing the Sabbath day and resting, God remembers his covenant promise that if you obey my voice, and one of those things was remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, if you obey my voice, which is written in the Decalogue, then you will be a holy nation and a kingdom of priests. And so God sees them keeping the Sabbath, and God remembers his promise with them. The promise that if they obey his voice, then they will be a special people and a kingdom of priests and a holy nation forever. Right? So there was an element of obedience introduced in the creation of the sign in the Abrahamic covenant. But I want you to notice something that didn't come out last night. I want to just mention this briefly. Remember we said that it was through man's willingness to do what God says, that circumcision, that the reality comes into existence. But notice this. In the case of Genesis 17:14, it wasn't the parents who didn't circumcise their children who were cut off from the covenant. It was the uncircumcised child that was cut off from the covenant. Read it carefully. So through the parental disobedience, it was their children that got cut off. If you didn't circumcise your son, then he, the uncircumcised son, was cut out. So by your disobedience, if you wouldn't do it, you cut your son out of the covenant. So that's important. But this case, it's not quite like that. In this case, it's they themselves were to be Sabbath keeping on Saturday. And when they did that, God was to look at it like he looked at the rainbow and remembered his promise. So there's a connection here between their evangelical obedience to the Ten Commandments and the fulfillment of this promise to the whole congregation. Consider with me Exodus Chapter 34, verses 27 and 28. This is in the renewal of the covenant. Exodus 34, 27 and 28. And the Lord said to Moses, write these words. Now, this time it's not the finger of God that writes them, but the finger of Moses. Write these words, for after the tenor of these words have I made a covenant with you and with Israel. And he was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights, neither did he eat bread nor drink water. And he wrote upon the tables the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. Now, what could be clearer? Right? Now you have the voice come out of heaven, and that which that voice said are now written on tables of stone. So you have the tables of stone, which contains what they heard the voice of God say. The first time, the tables were written with the finger of God. Then they were broken through their disobedience. Then, the second time, Moses writes them. The very same words that the voice of God said. These are the words of the old covenant. This is what they must keep. So they have the two documents of the old covenant. You have the book and you have the tables. Now, I want to tell you how absolutely and utterly significant this is. That people today tell us that, you know, some people tell us that you have to view the whole old covenant as a whole. You either keep it all or you throw it all out. They tell us that there's no exegetical basis in Scripture for any distinction whatsoever between moral, civil, and ceremonial law. And I would just like to tell you emphatically and plainly that that is absolutely not true. Amen. There is an exegetical basis in Scripture for a difference between moral law and ceremonial and civil law. And that difference is exegetical. That is, it grows out of the Bible. It's not something that theologians have cooked up. And what is the difference? It's between the book and the tables. The book and the tables are two different things. They're not identical. What's written in the book is the civil statutes and the ceremonies. What's written on the tables is the abiding, permanent, moral law of God for all men in all ages, which I trust will show you from the Scripture as time goes on. But I just want to show you right now that there is a difference. There's a very clear difference. And there is a biblical and Bible expository or exegetical basis for saying there are distinctions to be made in moral, civil, ceremonial law. It's not just something that theologians have imposed on the Bible. There is a difference. It's a very clear difference between the book and the tables. Now, there's a lot more to be said about how that's so. We'll get into it in a minute. All right? But in any event, let's move on to... let's see. There are a number of passages that I'm going to pass over, if I may. Okay? I'm going to pass over... number of passages that speak about, let me see if I want to at least read this one. Let me see what this one says. Yes. Well, here you find, I want to read Deuteronomy 32, 15 and 16, the first writing of the tables. And Moses turned and went down from the mountain with the two tables of the testimony in his hand, the tables that were written on both sides. On the one side and on the other were written, and the tables were the work of God, and the writing was the writing of God graven on the tables. Deuteronomy 32. The number of passages, 34:1, 31:18, 24:12. There's a special terminology for the tables in Exodus 24:12, where God tells Moses to come up to the mountain in the first place. And he's up there from Exodus 24 all the way to the end of Exodus 31. He's up there for seven chapters on the top of that mountain. So up there for eight chapters, up there for a long time. And God told him to come up and said, I will give you the tables. And it's called, in the Hebrew, I'm confusing the Greek and Hebrew in my head. And it's HaTorah V'HaMitzvah in the Hebrew. And in the Greek, Honamas Kahe Entole. Now, HaTorah means the law. V'HaMitzvah means the commandment, singular. And in Exodus 24, that special terminology is introduced. When God says, come up to the mountain, and I will give you HaTorah V'HaMitzvah, I will give you the law and the commandment. In the Greek, honamos, the law, kaihe entole, the commandment. The law and the commandment is special terminology. It's a hendiadys, I say. Some people say hendiadys. But it's two words that describe the one and the same thing, which is the tables of stone and what's written on them. And the tables of stone are referred to as the law, the commandment. And sometimes just the commandment, singular, is the tables of stone. Sometimes the law, singular, is the tables of stone. And sometimes the law and the commandment together are the tables of stone. And that's how they were first introduced in Exodus 24. Now, some of the translations say the law and the commandments, but it's not plural. It's not plural I think even one of the old Greek translations translates it as plural, but it's not plural, it's singular. It's the law and the commandment. And it's no accident that this very same terminology is used in Romans 7. And Paul speaks about the law and the commandment. He's talking about the tables of stone. That's the way they're introduced. So when we talk about the tables of stone here, there's a lot of biblical evidence about this. They're called the testimony. They're called the law and the commandment. Sometimes the commandment, sometimes the law, and sometimes the testimony. And the tables are the testimony. But those tables are the documents, as one of the important documents, which contain the substance and content of the Old Covenant. Now, there are other passages we could consider. We could consider Leviticus 26, 9, and 15. And I'm not going into these. 25 and 44 and 45 that speak about the conditionality. They talk about breaking the covenant, the vengeance of the covenant, etc. But I want you to consider with me Deuteronomy chapter 4, please, just briefly, because we can't go through all 20 of these texts. So Deuteronomy chapter 4. And some of those things that are written in Leviticus are repeated in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 4. Now this is very important. Moses is re-describing, he's describing what happened. He's reliving what happened. Okay? And in verse 10, we read this. The day that you stood before the Lord your God in Horeb, when the Lord said to me, remember Exodus 19, assemble the people, and listen to this, and I will make them hear my words, that they may learn to fear me all the days, and they may teach them to their children. And you came near, and you stood under the mountain, and the mountain burned with fire unto the heart of heaven, with darkness and cloud and thick darkness. And listen, the Lord spoke to you out of the midst of the fire. You heard the voice of words, but you saw no form, only heard a voice. And he, the Lord, declared to you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform, even the Ten Commandments, and he wrote them on two tables of stone. Now you see that ties it all together, doesn't it? Isn't that clear? They heard the voice. There's the voice. What did they hear? The Ten Commandments. And he wrote them on tables of stone. They were broken, and Moses wrote them on tables of stone. So this Deuteronomy 4:13. Now listen to this. Look what comes next. Then here you have the book. Verse 14, and the Lord commanded me at that time to teach you statutes and ordinances. Now listen to this, ladies and gentlemen, that you might do them where? In the land. In the land whither you go to possess it. Deuteronomy 4:14. And look how the book is connected to the land. The book of the law, that's why I say, it's the law of the land, and it's the land of the law. It's the law of the land, and the land of the law. It's the law of the land. The book of the law. That's like a constitution. That book is a constitution. For the people, it contains civil statutes and ordinances which they're supposed to do in the land. You can't do the things in that book if you don't live in that land. It's not even possible to do the book without the land. You have the land and the book, and the land and the book are connected intimately. That book had the things written in it that they were supposed to do in that land. It was like a constitution to be followed by the nation in the land when they live there. That's why I say it's the law of the land. The book is the law of the land. And the land is the land of the law. That is the land of the book. That's it. So that's very important, because remember the question you had the other night about the land? Remember that? Don't forget, it's the land of the law and the law of the land. And it has to do with the book. Closely connected with the book. Now, that's a very important text. That's why I want to read it to you. Okay, Deuteronomy. Next text is Leviticus Now, this is a very interesting text, too. This is a warning. And this warning is given to us in verse 23. Take heed to yourselves so that you don't forget the covenant of the Lord your God, which he made with you, and make a graven image in the form of anything that the Lord your God has forbidden you, because the Lord your God is a devouring fire and a jealous God. Where does that sound familiar? Where does that come from? Hebrews what? Hebrews 12. Right. Hebrews 12. So there's a warning given to them about the vengeance that is going to come upon them, that what's called in Leviticus and other places, the vengeance of the covenant. And we'll get to the vengeance of the covenant in a minute. All right, Deuteronomy chapter 5, verses 2 and 3. And Moses, verse 1, and Moses called unto Israel and said to them, Hear, O Israel, the statutes and the ordinances which I speak in your ears this day, that you may learn them and observe them to do. Jehovah our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. The Lord made not this covenant with our fathers, but with us, even us, who are all of us alive here today. And Jehovah spoke with you face to face, in the mountain, out of the midst of the Father, and fire, and I stood between the Lord and you at that time to show you the word of the Lord, because you were afraid because of the fire, and you didn't go up to the mountain. And so here again, you find these same things. Okay, and again, verse 22. These words, the Lord, after he repeats the Ten Commandments, he says, These words the Lord spoke unto all your assembly in the mount of fire, in the mount out of the midst of the fire, out of the cloud and great darkness, with a great voice. And he added no more. And he wrote them upon two tables of stone. And then he goes on to tell the story. And he gave them to me, and it came to pass when you heard the voice, while you were in the mountain, and your tribes, and you said, Behold, the Lord has showed us this great glory, and we have heard his voice. Verse 24, out of the midst of the fire, and we've seen this day that God speaks with man and live. Now why should we die? The great fire will consume us. Verse 26, for who is there of all flesh that has heard the voice of the living God speaking out of the midst of the fire as we have heard and lived? So Moses, you go near and hear all that the Lord will say and speak to us, that the Lord our God shall speak to you, and we'll hear it and do it. It's clear. Isn't it? Very plain, very clear. He's reminding them. And he's saying, this covenant, observe this. This covenant is not the same. When was it made? It was made in Horeb, in the wilderness. And this is a distinct covenant from the covenant that was made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God never said to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, if you obey my voice and keep my commandments, then you will be to me. He never said that. He said to them, unto thy seed I have given this land, and in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. That's the pledge he made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And this is my covenant which you shall keep, circumcise. That's what he said to them. And Moses is saying, what he said to us, he never said to the patriarchs. So this is made in history. It's made on, when? In the wilderness generation. Where? At Horeb. I'm sorry, I put that in the wrong place. That's a where, it's not a when. When? It's in the wilderness. The wilderness generation that got redeemed. Where? Horeb. How? Blood. It's not the same as the patriarchal covenant. All God's covenants are not the same. They're not identical. They don't have the same partakers, and they don't have the same promises. Though they're all intimately and closely bound together and united as expositions, if I may say, or progressive disclosures, if I may say, of that one and the same gospel promise made in the Garden of Eden and declared. But they're not identical. The pledge he makes to them is not identical with the pledge he made to the patriarchs. We mustn't blend them all together as though they're all the same thing when they're not. They're distinct, made at different times, in different places in history. And it says so. Is it clear? I'm Okay, now we come to Deuteronomy 29, from which the book gets its name. Now, the specific statutes are listed in Deuteronomy 12 to 26 that are in reference here. And there's a whole list of statutes that are listed that are, by the way, written in the book in Deuteronomy. And I always run into this problem, by the way, 12 to 26. I always run into the problem of I never have enough room on any board I've ever written on to put all this stuff on there. But in Deuteronomy 12 to 26, you have the record of the statutes and the several statutes and the religious ceremonies that have been now incorporated into the book in its completed form. That book that has been prepared throughout the wilderness. Now they're on the plains of Moab. And there are plains of Moab, and the book is being completed. And they're just about to enter into the promised land, and the book is now complete. The book wasn't completed in Exodus, because it was a book that they were supposed to do in the land. And over this period of 40 years in the wilderness, God's been adding to the book, giving them more and more and more of the constitution or, quote, body politic that they're supposed to follow when they get into the land. Now on the plains of Moab, this is completed. And the rest of it is recorded in Deuteronomy 12 to 26. Deuteronomy 27 and 28, they have the cursing and the blessing that's supposed to attend it, right? And Deuteronomy 29. These are the words of the covenant which the Lord commanded Moses to make with the children of Israel in the land of Moab, besides the covenant that he made with them in Horeb. Now, it is from that statement Deuteronomy gets its name from that statement. You know what Deuteronomy means? Second law, right? And this is the completion, the addition. So this is made in Moab, on the plains of Moab. And what you have here is the completion of the book. You have the book completed. So again, it's the book. The book of the law. That the law that they're supposed to follow in the land. It's still the wilderness generation. But now, it started out when they entered the wilderness. And now, the book is given to them, the completed book, in addition to what they had on the at Mount Sinai. It's given to them as a completed book here at the end of the wilderness, just as they're in the plains of Moab about to enter into the land of Canaan. How fitting that just as they enter the land, the book that they're to follow containing the law of the land is given to them just as they enter. Deuteronomy 29:1, very important text. Now that includes, as I may say, Deuteronomy, you have to see that with Deuteronomy 26:16 to 19, Deuteronomy 27:14 and 15, Deuteronomy 27:26, Deuteronomy 28:13 to 14, and it's ratified in conjunction with this ceremony of blessings and cursings as they enter into the land and leave the wilderness. And those are recorded in Deuteronomy 26, 27, and 28. The whole process of blessings and cursings and sanctions that are placed upon it. Sanctions that are placed upon it. It's ratified with all of these sanctions that come upon them as they are entering the land. So you might want to see those sanctions as part of the ratification ceremony, but there's really more than that, because there's not only the blessing, but associated with this is not only the if, then you will be blessed, but as they enter the land, there's also the negative side is opened up, and there's the warning, if not, then curse. And that's found at the end of the days in Deuteronomy 27 and 28. If, bless. If not, then curse. So these are the sanctions and the sanctions ceremony that went along with the ratifying of the covenant on the plains of Moab. Okay. Verse 9 of Deuteronomy 29 says, therefore keep the words of this covenant that you may prosper in all that you do. You stand, all of you, this day before the Lord your God. Your heads, your tribes, your elders, your officers, all the men of Israel, your little ones, your wives, your sojourners. Verse 12, that you may enter into the covenant of the Lord your God and into his oath. There's enter into his solemn pledge. That is into his oath, which the Lord makes with you this day. The design of it is in order that he may establish you this day to himself for a people, that he may be to you a God, as he spoke to you, as he swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So, you see, this is how he takes them to himself for a people, by entering into covenant with them, just as we said. And it's in the wilderness generation. He enters into covenant with them at the plains of Moab. He begins it there, and he completes these covenantal espousals, taking them to himself for a people. I meant at the Mount Sinai. And closes this at the plains of Moab. Begins at Sinai, ends at Moab, thus takes them to himself for a people. Okay? Deuteronomy chapter 30 says this. Verse 9, and Jehovah your God will make you plenteous in all the work of your hand, and in the fruit of your body, and the fruit of your cattle, and the fruit of your God, and the fruit of your ground for good. For the Lord will again rejoice over you for good, as he rejoiced over your fathers, if you shall obey the voice of the Lord your God to keep his commandments and his statutes, which are written in this book of the law, if you turn unto Jehovah your God with all your heart and with all your soul. So it's talking about the statutes written in the book as being an essential part of this covenant of God. Okay? 21. Oh, yeah, here you go. Deuteronomy 29:21. And Jehovah will set him apart to evil out of all the tribes of Israel according to all the curses of the covenant that is written in this book of the law. And then, when they come under the wrath of God, verse 25, then men shall say, why did this wrath come? Because they forsook the covenant of the Lord their God, which he made with them when he brought them out of the land of Egypt, and they went and served other gods. Verse 29, the secret things belong to the Lord our God, but the things that are revealed belong to us and our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law. So here you have successive generations. And all the words of the law is all that's written on the tables of stone and all that's written in the book of the law. Okay. Any questions about what we have seen so far? Yes.
So I was just kind of, I peeked over to chapter 30 and talked about the restoration. When it talks about you will then again do the commandments which I command you this day, so really talking then, am I going too far? Is there something you're going to cover later on, or is this something you can cover right now? I don't want to go in too far into this. This restoration, is it what we're looking forward to as the church? Is this something that they would never achieve because they'd never really turn back to follow God as they were told to? And well, then what is this commandment they would keep then?
Okay, in the context Moses is prophesying to them. If you read, I mean, I haven't taken the time to read all those chapters, okay? But if you actually take the time and read the rest at the end of 26 and 27 and 28 and 29, you'll find that Moses is telling them the story of Israel's history. He's telling the story, he's prophesying to them the story of what's going to happen to them. And he talks about them keeping it and blessing, and then all of a sudden they break it and they come under the curse, and then they turn again and they're restored. It's talking about the whole history of Israel. It's talking about their period of blessing, their period of judgment, and their period of restoration. And the whole thing is prophesied to them right there at the very foundation. And that's what actually is going on there. Okay? Yes. That's referring to the book that is spoken of here that contains the statutes and the ceremonies that the people were to do in the land. The book contains moral, civil, and ceremonial law. It's all written in the book. It's a combination of all three. I'm not sure which passage you're speaking about, but there's one passage in there that speaks about the responsibility of the king to read in the book so that the king remembers to lead the people in the right way. I'm not sure exactly what you took. It's broader than that?
No, that's fine. But I don't know the
reference.
Joshua 1:8. Okay, so anyway, what exactly is your question? Well, my understanding of it is whenever it's referring to the book, it's talking about this book of the law that contains moral, civil, and ceremonial laws.
So what was the distinction you're making
now? The distinction that I'm making is between the book and the tables.
Okay.
See, the real issue with that is not so much for people who lived back then. The real issue is how does this old covenant now apply to us in the New Testament era? And I'm laying the foundation for saying that we are no longer required to do everything that's found in the book, but that we now, as Christians, have what's written on the tables written on our hearts. And the book of the law is no longer the constitution for the Christian church. What we learn from the book of the law is we learn the general righteousness, the general equity of those civil principles, and we see the ceremonies fulfilled in Christ. So that the book of the law no longer applies to us as a body politic or as a constitution for the Christian church or Christian Israel. But what's on the tables of stone is written on the hearts of God's people, and that is the new covenant. I will write what's on the tables, the law of God, on their hearts.
And that's
what's in
Hebrews, right?
Yes, it's Hebrews and it's a quote of Jeremiah 31. It's not just in Hebrews, also in Galatians. So anyway, that was the point I was making. I was laying a foundation for coming to that, is what I was actually doing. Okay, does that help? Good.
I think what was confusing her, if I understood her question,
yes,
was that you were mentioning how the moral law is also contained in the book, but that still doesn't mean that the book is not distinguished from the tables.
That's correct.
That the tables is purely moral law.
Yes.
The Ten Commandments.
That's right.
The book has moral law, ceremonial law,
and civil law all together, right. Now, I want you to notice one final passage before we move on here, and that's in Deuteronomy chapter 31, the significant role of the two documents of the law as they're crossing the river. Deuteronomy 31:24, and it came to pass when Moses made an end of writing the words of this law in a book until they were all finished, that Moses commanded the Levites that bear the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, saying, take this book of the law and put it by the side of the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God, that it may be there for a witness. So they took this book of the law, and there were only two things there by the Ark of the Covenant. Do you know what those two things were? The book of the law and the tables of stone. It was the book of the law and the tables of stone, and that was there.
Weren't the tables of stone in it?
Yep.
And the book of the law is beside it then?
Yep. Those two things were there. The book of the law and the tables of stone. Okay? So you had the two documents of the covenant there by the ark. The book of the law and the tables of stone. Right? So that's the substance of the covenant. That's how, when, and where it's mediated. These are the partakers of the covenant. We learned that so far. The token of the covenant. The only question is the mediation of the old covenant. In my mind, it's clear from what we've seen so far that it was mediated by Moses. It says in John chapter 1, it reflects back on this. 1:17 says the law was given through Moses. Acts 7:38 says it was ordained by angels by the hands of a mediator. Exodus 20:19 indicates that Moses was the go-between. Galatians 3:19 says something very similar. Numbers 12:7 and Deuteronomy 5:5 and Exodus 34:27 and 28 all indicate that Moses was the mediator of the old covenant. All of those passages. So you have the partakers, the initial generation, successive generations of Jews. We haven't got into the final generation yet. I haven't addressed that question yet. Gotten into that yet. But so far we got all of those. We got all the features pretty much. When, how, and where? The wilderness generation and Horeb and Moab. How? Through blood and through the blessing and cursing and through the meal. What? The voice of God, the Ten Commandments, the tables of stone. What? The book for the land. And along with it, the blessing, the promise of blessing. This is the condition. And then the threat of cursing if it's broken. I don't know, does that inductive method make it unclear and difficult to follow for you? I don't know. Okay. Now, there's a number of other passages here. It's 8 o'clock. When do we, are we getting almost time that I have, we have to turn this tape off? How much time do I have?
2 minutes.
Two? We'll take a break. Let's take a break.